Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
Smile a While with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Gertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Bank, a friendly bank in a friendly town. Now here is your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio historian-collector Ed Corcoran. Well, Ed, our guest tonight is not only an actor, but an author as well.
Yes, he has a new book out, This Was Radio, which all of our fans, I'm sure, will want to read. And to our TV viewers, he appears as Vic Kirby on the Somerset, the daytime soap opera. So, Dick, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Joseph Julian.
Joe, it's good to have you with us tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You indicated to me that you were rather well qualified to write this book. You said, well, I think I was involved with some $20,000 or shows, or what were we talking about specifically, Joe?
Well, actually, I've done about 20,000 radio dramas the past 30 years. That is, while radio drama was alive.
That gives you quite a background, I would think.
Yes, quite.
Where were you from? Where did you start out from?
You mean as a human person?
Well, no, as far as this business is concerned.
Well, I started really at this WNYC in New York during the WPA days when they had projects for unemployed actors to put everybody to work, you know. There was a project there at WNYC, a radio project, which was mainly propaganda for keeping the streets clean. Mm-hmm. We could use a project like that today, I think. And from there, I went out to WLW in Cincinnati, which at that time was the biggest, most powerful radio station in the world.
This must have been the time when WLW was 500,000 watts.
500,000 watts, that's right.
Heard from coast to coast.
That's right. It practically blanketed the country, especially the late night hours.
You know the reason for that, Dick, why it was 500,000 watts?
I don't know the reason, except I would assume that they could be heard better.
I think it was for national defense or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was my understanding that the government made an exception. They didn't allow other stations to have that kind of power. But they made an exception in this case because it was centrally located in the country, and in case of an emergency, a war emergency of some kind, they could reach all the people immediately rather than developing a complicated network setup.
Now, were you there as an actor, or in what capacity?
Well, I went out as an actor, but I was fired after the first 3 weeks before I felt I really had a chance to demonstrate my talent. And I bitterly complained to the man who brought me out there, so they offered me a job as assistant sound effects man.
So you produced the sound for the drama that was broadcast in WLW.
I produced some of it, yeah.
Didn't you work with Red Barber on occasion?
Oh, yeah, that was one of my first sound effect assignments. Red Barber was, he was a genius in a way. He used to describe baseball games from the ticker tape, you know.
Yeah.
But he was so colorful in his description of events. He pretended he was there at the stadium while it was happening, but he was just in a little studio, you know. And I was supplying the sound effects with a bat smacking against a ball. Well, we didn't actually use the bat and ball. We used the judge's gavel, which I hit the bat with. But he would say, well, the ball's soaring over left field fence now. There it goes, and it's a home run. You know, so it's happening at that moment.
Yeah.
He was a great sleight-of-mouth artist.
You didn't have to produce the crowd sound effect by blowing air into the microphone or anything like that, did you?
That I never heard of, blowing air. No, but I started out. My first job in radio was an extra on the March of Time, being a part of a crowd noise.
Mm-hmm.
For $5 a throw.
What's the story concerning the ambulance?
Oh, after about 2 years of trying to really break into big-time radio, I suddenly got myself two jobs in one day. And the times overlapped, and it never occurred to me to give one of them up. You know, the gods didn't want me to have this bounty. They wouldn't have offered it to me. So I accepted it, and then I realized the problem afterwards. I had about 7 minutes to get across town in New York from Madison Avenue CBS to WHN, which was at 46th Street and Broadway. So I timed myself running, and it didn't make it. So I decided I'd hire an ambulance. So I called up, I got an ambulance number from the yellow pages. And I asked them how much they'd charge, and they said, $12 if you're an invalid, $15 if you're not. So why the difference? Because it's against the law to carry you if you're not an invalid. So it was a wild ride. The ambulance was waiting for me, and I tipped the elevator man on both buildings, you know, in advance. And I ran out of the studio. When I finished, it was Merton Marge, the CBS show. And the elevator wasn't there, and I nearly broke my thumb pressing the down button. Every second was precious.
Certainly.
So there, the ambulance guy is waiting for me, and he says, "Look, now I can take a chance on going across town. It's a much shorter distance that way, but I might get caught in traffic even with my siren, or I can go up Madison Avenue and across 57th Street where it's wide, and I come down that way. It'll take a little longer. I mean, it'll be shorter, even though it seems it'll be a longer route." So I said, "All right, go that way." And he started with the siren screaming, and then the siren broke down, turned into around 7th Avenue, 57th Street. And he said, "I can get out and fix it, but it'll take about a minute." And he said, "Go ahead, go on right through, you know." So we went right through, and the cars were jamming on their brakes, you know, to avoid collisions. And I got there, and I ran out of the ambulance, which was a strange sight for the passers-by there. And they think I was running from an ambulance. And the elevator was waiting for me there, and I got in and took me up, and I just had time to take one gulp of breath and speak. But it taught me a lesson never to try anything like that again. Actually, I lost money on the deal after paying for a standing.
But it was a challenge. Why did you write the book, This Was Radio?
Well, I thought it would give a lot of people pleasure. I think it has a big nostalgia appeal for people who knew those days, the older people, the older generations. But more importantly, I think it has an extraordinary appeal to young people who missed the era, who do not know what happened at that time. I find them avidly interested in the book.
You get reaction from them? They write
oh,
you?
Oh, yes, yes. And those that I speak to.
Very good. Well, I thought maybe since we've heard you live, we'd like to hear you back when you were doing radio, and we have an excerpt here from X-1, science fiction, of course. And this concerns a situation with a time machine where you're trapped back in the prehistoric times. So John Larkin is on here with you, who used to be quite a prominent TV personality. So why don't we hear how Julian used to sound when he was doing his radio bit, Dick?
All right, let's do that.
Hope I didn't have an off day.
Countdown for blast off. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. Transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future. Adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on 1,000 maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents Tonight, Project Mastodon by Clifford D. Simak.
secretary, may I present Mr. Hudson of,
Macedonia.
Macedonia. Mr. Hudson, this is the Secretary of State.
Honored, sir.
Now, as chief of protocol for the department, I've informed...
All right, Mr. Kingston, I haven't much time. I'm due at a meeting of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at 2. If you pass Mr. Hudson in, I'll assume everything is quite proper. Now then, Mr. Hudson, I understand you've been here several times seeking recognition for your, country.
Well, that's right. I had a hard time making your staff believe I was in earnest.
And are you, Mr. Hudson?
Oh, very much so.
You are an American, Mr. Hudson. I assume you are acting as a representative for Macedonia rather than as a principal in the matter.
Oh, no. I claim dual citizenship, sir. I am a Macedonian.
You'll pardon me, but I've never heard of your country.
Well, it's a new nation, but quite legitimate. We have a constitution, a democratic form of government, duly elected officials, and a code of laws. We are a free, peace-loving people, and we are possessed of a vast amount of natural resources. And...
Please tell me, Mr. Hudson, just where are you located? I gathered it was somewhere in Asia?
Oh, no. Technically, you are our nearest neighbor. That's ridiculous. Now, look here, Hudson, you can't... If you'll give me just a moment, Mr. Secretary, I have considerable evidence...
I'll have to ask you to leave. I'm sorry, sir.
Go ahead, Mr. Hudson. You've submitted a document signed by a certain Wesley Adams.
Well, he's our first president. You see, we'd like to establish diplomatic relations. After all, we are a sister republic. We'd like to negotiate a trade agreement, and, of course, we'd be grateful for assistance under the Foreign Aid Program.
Naturally. Who wouldn't?
Mr. Secretary.
All right, Kingston.
We're prepared to offer something in return for, one thing. Sanctuary.
Sanctuary?
I understand that in the present state of international tensions, a foolproof sanctuary is not something to be sneezed at.
All right, Kingston, I think we've had enough. Show Mr. Hudson out.
Hello? Is this Dr. Harrison of the Paleontology Department? This is Mr. Jenkins at the Federal Bureau of Investigation. We have some movie film we'd like you to look over. Huh? Oh, we acquired it. Big shaggy elephants and tigers with teeth down to their neck. No, it's not fakes. Our labs are sure of that. Whatever is on those films is real. No, we don't know. That's why we called you. We haven't the slightest idea where those pictures were shot. We can't even guess.
What's the matter, Coop?
One of those flying hypodermics. This is a fine, healthy spot. Mosquitoes as big as hummingbirds.
Oh, careful, son. You're knocking the climate of the capital city of Macedonia.
Yeah, some capital city. One palm tree and a Boy Scout pup tent. Wes, this is the wildest thing we ever did. What if Chuck can't get back?
Chuck Hudson is a man of many parts. Have faith.
Supposing they're putting him in jail, or something might happen to the time unit or the helicopter. We should have gone along.
Do you think they'll do it, Coop?
Oh, what?
The United States. Do you think they'll recognize us?
Not if they know that Macedonia is the United States 50,000 years ago.
Well, we have to get legal recognition first, otherwise it wouldn't be safe. Well, there goes that mastodon again. Good old. Buster.
Where is it?
Right there. We'll let it go, see? Ah, he's lonely.
What?
It probably is. He must have been run out of the herd by some younger bull. That's why he hangs around like some homeless dog.
One thing worries me, Wes. I know you dreamed up the time unit, and we all chipped in for the helicopter, but can you just claim territory on your own like we did?
Why not? We found it, it's ours.
Hey, Buster's coming this way. Give me the right.
No, wait. Maybe he's only bluffing.
If that mastodon comes through here, he'll stomp everything flat. I'll give him 3 steps more.
Oh, it'd be such a shame to plaster him. He's such a nice old monster.
1 more step and he gets it. Hey, Chuck, he's back. I wish he could fly that helicopter better. He might wreck it.
Well, anyway, he scared Buster off.
Poke those fires up, Wes.
Oh, they're high enough, Coop.
You don't want a saber-tooth walking through here, do you?
Well, we better get a stockade up. You know, some night a herd of mastodon will come busting in here, and if they ever hit the helicopter, we'll be dead ducks. We'd never get back. We'd be stuck back here in the Pleistocene Age.
I won't feel safe till we get another helicopter.
Those mastodons carry a lot of ivory. And the mammoths up north.
Oh, sure, sure. And get socked in the jug for smuggling ivory. Only way to cash in on the time unit is to get diplomatic recognition for Macedonia.
We've got a good case. You said so yourself.
The saber tooth?
Down by the grove.
I don't like that. Sounds closer. Hey, poke up that fire, will you, Coop?
Ah, well, that's Buster.
There he is. Hangling with a saber tooth.
Way 3 to 5 on Buster.
That's drawing blood. I'll take $5 of it.
Come on, Buster. Roll on him, will you?
Cap's on his head now. Hey, he's coming this way.
Look out! Wes, turn him. Shoot!
There's a new member in the family. The Cromwell Savings Bank family, that is. And starting this Saturday, you'll find the same friendly and reliable service at the Cromwell Plaza office that's been in their family since 1871. You're invited to the grand opening this Saturday from 9 to noon. And if you decided to open a new savings account, now's the time to go to the Cromwell Plaza office. Right now, they're giving away a free coupon for a 5x7 Loring portrait for the $50 deposit, an 8x10 Loring portrait coupon for the $100 deposit, and a choice of 3 handsome decorator clocks for the deposit of $5,000 at the new Cromwell Savings Bank Plaza office. Start your new savings bank account at Cromwell Savings Bank's Plaza office and know your family's finances are in good hands. They'll be open Monday through Thursday, 10 to 4:30 p.m., Friday, 10 to 7:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 9 to noon. Visit Cromwell Savings Bank's Plaza office this Saturday for refreshments and your free gift. Open a new savings account and join the family. You'll be glad you did.
Our guest tonight is Joseph Julian, and we're talking about his new book, This Was Radio, a personal memoir, with an introduction by Harold Clurman. Let's get back to your career, Joe, because it's absolutely fascinating. As a matter of fact, this isn't the first thing you've written, this book, This Was Radio. You wrote several essays for Variety in the past, didn't you?
I wrote some articles on radio acting, and I've written some plays.
When you wrote these articles, didn't you get quite a bit of flack from the various people in the industry?
Oh, yeah. That was when I first started. I thought that actors degenerated as creative performers in radio because they had to do it so quickly, you know, that they developed a bag of tricks, you know. Anyway, I wrote it as a form, in the form of a letter to Variety, and the editor smelled a hot controversy here, you know, so he... He shot out telegrams to all the big shots in the business, not only the radio business, but in the film world, the theater world, Bing Crosby, Irene Rich, you know, and they all answered me the next day. The next week I picked up Variety thinking there'd be a little letter maybe in comment to the editor. It was 4 full pages, answers for Joe Julian, with my name, bold captions on each one, you know, thinks Julian should be psychoanalyzed, disagrees with Julian, but, you know, and I thought, well, I'm finished for sure now in radio. I went to see Landry, the editor of Variety, and he says, don't be silly. He said, you couldn't buy publicity like this for $50,000. You'll be busier than ever. And ironically enough, it came true. I'm writing this article on how actors degenerate in radio. I got busier than ever.
Didn't you contrast the Hollywood actors versus radio actors in your field? Was a definite difference in the techniques, or that once a radio actor became... good in his craft, that he really was untouchable as far as being able to do the job.
Oh, he was much better in radio than these Hollywood stars who very often would make guest appearances in dramatic shows who had no real radio technique. There was a definite technique to radio acting.
I was just going to ask you, do you still feel that way about the bag of tricks that the radio actors acquired, or did you gain more respect for them?
Well, I gained more respect for them, but even their bag of tricks is quite an accomplishment, you know, in its own right. I don't think that would help them in the theater or in film, in visual acting.
The problem was, I suppose, that there was a limited number of actors who worked regularly, and so they had to be flexible. They had to be able to acquire accents.
That's right, versatility, yeah. Quickness.
Yeah, and this they had. They were able to work with.
This they developed, yeah.
Well, also, many times they would make these cuts just prior to going on the air. You'd rehearse a script, and at the last minute they'd say, cut this, cut this, cut this, and then you go on the air, and you got to remember, you got to do it right, or the whole thing will blow up.
That's
so
right.
That must be quite a skill in itself be able to adapt that quickly, because on a stage, once you learn a role, that's it. But in radio, it seemed like it could change up to the last second before you went on the air.
That's absolutely true.
Did you have
I had great respect for these actors who developed those techniques.
Did you have any particular way of doing it yourself, any of these last minute changes, or how did you keep alert so you wouldn't have the problem of saying the line that was cut or run over or anything like that?
Well, I don't know how to answer that.
You just did it, I guess. That's about the best way to describe it, you know?
Yeah, I had a kind of a... I was considered a bit of a nut by many of my peers in radio because I at one point in my career... I was very serious about improving radio acting by learning the lines and memorizing lines, even though I didn't have to. I thought, you know, I could relate better to somebody across the microphone if I was free from the script.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that within the rehearsal period, even though it was short, most parts couldn't be learned. There were only a few paragraphs. And I developed a technique of learning them, then marking my script places I wasn't sure, you know, so... Excuse me. I could always fall back on the script if I had to.
Well, you were doing a memorized performance then for the most part.
You were involved with soaps, weren't you, Joe?
Oh, yes. I probably was on it.
One of the shows that you were on for a long period of time was Lorenzo Jones. What part did you play?
Well, I played part of Sandy. He was a young kid who lived next door to Lorenzo, and he worshipped Lorenzo. That incidentally was, well, I think, the best soap opera on the air.
It certainly was the funniest. I think you'll have to agree with that.
Yeah. It had genuine humor and wit, charm. The character of Lorenzo was a would-be inventor. He was always inventing things that were almost practical, but not quite.
Yeah.
Like
the
three-spout teapot for strong, weak, and medium tea. And once he invented a gadget... for his automobile, he had a recording thing, and so that if you went over a certain speed limit, a voice would come snarling out of the loudspeaker saying, "Take it easy, bud."
But, of course, these ideas were so wonderful on radio because you could visualize all
That's
of them.
Right.
You had no problems there. You, in the book, you use one of the openings, I guess, and I wonder if you read that for us, because this is, I think, so typical of the types of things that an announcer was called upon to read in order to capsulize what had already taken place.
Yeah, for new listeners,
right.
They have to recapitulate every day part of the story. So the announcer would say something like, "Yesterday we left Alice in her living room, alone with John Hennessy, her sister Gwendolyn's husband. John had just confided that he had always been in love with Alice and had made a terrible mistake in marrying Gwendolyn. Gwendolyn, who had left the house moments before, suddenly remembered she had forgotten some books she wanted to return to the library. As she re-entered the living room, John had just put his arm around Alice's waist. Gwendolyn froze as she heard John say, 'Darling, I love you more than anything in this world.'"
Did you ever hear the story about one of the famous announcers that he had to go in a booth to do these things, and he took a sharp pencil with him, and he used to jab himself in the arm to keep him laughing?
No, I didn't. Never heard of that one.
That's really, he couldn't do it with a straight face, and his arm was all bruised for a while. That's the only way he could do it.
Well, I suppose with enough pain, you don't laugh. What about the war? The war came along, and you were very much involved with that, weren't you, Joe?
Yes, a performance in Norman Corwin's series called This Is War which was carried on all networks. That was kind of an umbrella title for a series of programs about the war effort. He cast me once in the lead in a section called To the Young, which I played a young soldier on his way to war. Well, this performance was directly responsible for landing me smack in the midst of a real war about 2 weeks later. Norman Corwin, who was a radio genius, mm-hmm. who probably expanded radio's horizons more farther than any other person, he was over in London to do this series called An American in England, which was an average American's impressions of the British people at war, and it was the purpose of it was to cement better relations between England and America. And he wanted Burgess Meredith originally, I think, for the lead in this, and the Army wouldn't let him out or something. Anyway, he sent for me, and CBS flew me over there in a bomber on a very short notice. I spent 6 weeks over there in London during the bombing, doing the series.
Did you get into any tight squeezes while you were there, or were you fairly lucky?
Well, I was fairly lucky. There was a lot of anti-aircraft fire, and a few bombs fell in the area where I was staying. But I was pretty lucky in that way. Yes.
Mm. Well, you met a man who played a very important role later in your career. Edward R. Murrow, wasn't he over there at the same time?
Yeah, Ed was the producer of this series, An American in England.
Was he 10 feet tall when you were...
Yes, he was 12 feet tall in my dictionary.
He really was something else.
He was a fine man.
Did you actually become a war correspondent at this point? Or?
No, when I came back from London, I had been to Dover, and I wrote a documentary under my experience in Dover when I was over there, and it was done on the Blue Network. And about a year later, the Red Cross got in touch with me. They had heard this broadcast, and they wanted somebody to handle a program for them in the Philippines. That was before the war had ended. They had somebody who was doing kind of a PA job, you know, on the Red Cross activities, and it was kind of dull, and they talked to me about doing it. And I talked them into letting me do these 3-minute broadcasts back to the United States about whatever I saw, whatever interested me there, and obliquely getting in little plugs for the Red Cross activities. So anyway, the war ended before I got to the Philippines, so I went immediately to Japan during the first phases of the occupation, and I was a radio correspondent over there.
Well, all of this started really with the work of Norman Corwin, and Ed, I wonder if you'd delve into your collection of Norman Corwin productions and play something for us.
Well, they're very hard to get a hold of, Dick, but I did happen to find one, and let's listen to it now.
Columbia presents Corwin.
CBS honors the return to the air of one of radio's first talents, Norman Corwin. Each Tuesday evening during the next 26 weeks on these programs, you will hear music, drama, comedy, fantasy, operas, documentaries, the entire range of the versatile Corwin art which has in the past brought you many familiar radio classics. Tonight, Columbia presents Corwin's Movie Primer with music by Lynn Murray.
This is a movie primer. The most elementary show you've heard. An alphabetical primer.
A-B-C-D-F-E.
Degree by degree from A to Z, our primer will prim the movie industry.
The movie industry.
A stands for ads. What are ads?
Movie ads are tempting advertisements which entice you not to miss the pictures they are advertising, but in spite of which, people go to see the pictures anyway.
A writer has to be gifted in order to write ads for the movies, for he is dealing in unforgettable commodities, which no person can afford to miss them.
The most gifted ad writer of them all was Magnum J. Naphtha, who left among his papers when he died under mysterious circumstances in 1928, a freestyle cantata entitled, You Can't Afford to Miss It, which we now give the premiere performance of it.
Oh, got two public to attend your old, but his brains go back to his smile. Knocked him cold with a smoking pole and a shapely leg for his eye. Tell him he'll want to laugh and cry. Tell him he'll want to cheer and hit. But whatever you tell him this. It's a picture you can't afford to miss.
It's a picture you can't afford to miss.
An unbeatable drama of today's immortal brand of courage and love.
It's a picture you can't afford to miss.
Dashing, fascinating, impulsive, he risked the kingdom for this one kid.
Oh, show him a villain with an ugly smirk and a man and a maid in the park. And a smoking gun in the hands of a jerk and a passionate pair in the dark. Tell him it's the greatest drama yet. Tell him he'll thrill to every kiss. But whatever you tell him, don't forget, it's a picture you can't afford to miss.
It's a picture you can't afford to miss.
Here is majesty, glory, magnificence. A motion picture beyond human description, but within the reach of every human heart.
This is a picture you can't afford to miss. This is a picture you can't afford to miss. To miss.
B stands for boy. What is boy?
A boy is what has to meet girl before he can lose girl and then find same again.
Boy meets girl is one of the most ancient and honorable formulas in the movies.
This is not only fitting, but true to life. Because if boys didn't meet girls regularly, as a matter of course, where would we all be today?
Mostly the formula is boy meets girl, boy loses girl, and boy finds girl. But every now and then, there's a refinement on this formula. As in the case of the picture Random Harvest, see figure one, which went something like this.
Boy loses mind, boy finds girl. Boy finds mind, boy loses girl. Girl finds boy.
Of course, this classic formula of boy meets girl varies in different countries. In France, before the war, one of the favorite variations was...
Boy meets girl.
And in China, a very old land whose culture goes even further back than the Golden Age... The ancestral formula is...
Hey,
hey, wait a minute. You're giving away the whole story.
Very sorry.
All right, next letter.
C. C stands for columnist. What is a columnist?
A movie columnist is a columnist who writes about movies and the innermost thoughts and habits of movie people in a most innermost and intimate way.
A few columnists have become so famous that legendary poems have gotten to be written about them. As, for example, the inscription found on a movie temple in Cairo near the Great Pyramid of Thebes.
Life is just Tobolsky of Sidney Skolsky.
But a certain school of columnists is very paternal toward movie stars. They write gabby open letters to stars, which everybody would just assume they were closed letters.
Here is a typical open letter offering sound advice to Claire Trevor. D. D stands for dialogue. What is dialogue?
Dialogue is the things people say to each other in talking pictures.
It varies according to who's talking to whom.
In figure four below, you will see how the great Russian director Sergei Butadayin of the Dniepropetrovsk Art Theater demonstrates various kinds of dialogue.
Now, what is first known dramatic dialogue in earliest primitive drama? The answer is, who was that lady I seen you was last night with? That was no lady, that was my wife. Now, in cowboy pictures, is must be different expression. Here is cowboys speaking.
Clem Logan, I'm offering you a simple choice. Either you come clean and tell us who that lady was you were seen robbing the mail train with last night, or else.
Sheriff, reckon I don't mind telling you. That was no lady. That was Tiger Lily Lou. And this for you.
But in smart, English drawing room pictures, same dialogue is must be also still different. As example,
I say, Begley, old sport, who was that lady I saw you making time with last night?
I dare say that was no lady, Trammell. That was your wife.
Oh, touché, Begley. Well done, old boy. Neat.
Thanks, old fella. Here's mud in your eye.
Bottoms up.
But in a musical-type picture is altogether different problem. In such instance, dialogue is lyrics to music.
Cromwell Savings Bank announces the grand opening of the Cromwell Plaza office this Saturday, 9 to noon, with giveaways for all new savings accounts. For a $50 deposit, they'll give you a coupon for a beautiful 5x7 Loring portrait of someone you love, or deposit $100 for an 8x10 portrait coupon. And when you deposit $5,000 in your new savings account at Cromwell Plaza, they'll give you your choice of an authentic 20-inch reproduction of a classic grandfather clock, a colonial decorator wall clock, or a handsome contemporary wall clock. Isn't it time you put your family's finances in the hands of a reliable savings bank? Start your new savings account at the new Cromwell Savings Bank's Plaza office, where you'll be given personal attention on all your banking needs. They'll be open Monday through Thursday, 10 to 4:30 p.m., Friday, 10 to 7:30 p.m., and, for your convenience, Saturdays, 9 to 12 noon. Remember to stop by this Saturday between 9 and noon for the grand opening of the Cromwell Savings Bank Plaza office near Kmart in Cromwell. Refreshments and gifts will be given to all visitors.
Our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio is actor Joseph Julian, whose new book, This Was Radio, is fascinating reading. And we certainly urge you to get a copy of it if you'd like to really know about this era of broadcasting here in America, published by the Viking Press and available at your favorite bookstore. Joe, did you become involved with the infamous blacklist, the Joseph McCarthy era?
I certainly did. It cost me my livelihood for about 3 years. I was very innocently involved, I might add, and I sued this publication, Red Channels, which included was a little pamphlet that listed 151 actors, writers, directors who presumably were involved in left-wing activities. It had a red hand clutching a microphone, and it was a very libelous publication.
How did you get your name in there?
Well, there were two things, two listings that I had in this book. One, when I came back from England, I got a lot of publicity in the papers here. And I was invited to read a poem at Carnegie Hall about artists who died fighting fascism. And there were all shades of political opinion there. You know, Lenny Dowling, Mary Margaret McBride, everybody was there. And I just read this poem. Well, I was listed by some California legislative committee mentioned that I was a speaker at this meeting, which 10 years before had been called subversive, this committee that organized it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was that I had once signed a petition to abolish the House Un-American Activities Committee, which I did. And the chairman of that committee, we eventually went to jail.
You were anyway, right. That didn't help.
So what happened?
Anyway, this was used as almost in every casting director's desk drawer, you know, as a list of people to be avoided. And it was a horrendous period in American life and in the life of radio actors and other performers.
Yeah, I think it really categorizes this whole McCarthy witch hunt era so well. And the reason, I suppose, that the producers went along with it was because of the involvement of sponsors and so on, tremendous pressures.
They were scared, and they had their own jobs to protect, and there was a lot of pressure from sponsors, certain sponsors, not all. There was one fellow in Syracuse named Johnson. He owned 6 supermarkets, and he worked together in collusion with a committee of members of our union, actually. They would feed him names, and he would send telegrams to sponsors. And almost every product that was sponsored on the air was on his shelves in a supermarket. So he would send telegrams to them saying, do you want Stalin's little creatures crawling all over your products, you know, if you don't get rid of this actor, that actor? Why, we'll take all your products off our shelves. Boycott. Well, our sponsors are very sensitive to this.
Yeah.
And they were pressured into not hiring and firing any actors who were suspect.
Did you sue, and were you successful?
I sued. I was successful in a moral sense, and actually financially it turned out to be successful, although Irving Seipel, who was the judge in the case, granted the defense motion to dismiss on grounds that I didn't prove a prima facie case. And the burden of their defense was that I was one of the innocent people listed in the fine print, you know, in the preface, the statement of the effect, a disclaimer to the effect that there may be some innocent people in here also. But the kind of people who came down and testified for me, Ed Murrow and Charles Collingwood, that all redounded to my interest later, because with these kind of people sponsoring me, I started, right after the trial was over, I started getting calls for employment.
In your opinion, when did radio begin to decline?
Well, as television began to ascend.
Did you have much of a chance to go into television as many of your peers did at that time?
I did the first dramatic show that CBS ever did.
You were a real pioneer.
Huh?
You were a real pioneer in every sense of the word.
Yeah, it was a 12-minute thing. There was only one stationary camera. You couldn't move it to follow the actors, you know. It was like almost like a stage production. And
can you tell us when? This had to go back a long way.
Well, I don't remember the exact date that was, but...
30s, 40s?
Either the... I think it was the late 40s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I remember there were only about 200 experimental television sets in the city at that time. They were programming these things experimentally, you know. And I remember the director took us over to his house afterwards, and there was a fight on television. It was a championship fight of some kind. I forget who was fighting. But the only way you could tell the difference between the two boxers was one had white shorts and the other had dark shorts. The images were so unclear.
Yeah, yeah. This had to go back probably to the late 30s, I would think. That would seem to me late 40s would...
No, it came back. It was right after I came back from England, uh-huh. Which was in 1942.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I said late 40s.
Yeah.
I was wrong. Yes, you're right about that.
Well, at any rate, you did make it successfully over into television. You're very much a part of the television scene today. And what part do you play on Somerset, the daytime NBC soap?
I play Vic Kirby, kind of a mysterious, interesting handyman figure who could be up to no good or not.
I'd like to hear again from Joe at work, and maybe you can supply that to us right now.
Well, Dick, you know, I'm a science fiction fan from way back, and Joe did an awful lot of that work, and this is another series called 2000 Plus, which was well thought of at the time. And here he plays the part of a giant, so let's listen, shall we?
I remember.
Adventures in the world of tomorrow. Dramatic stories of science fiction from the years beyond 2000 AD. Today, an amazing story of